One, two, three, four.
Hello and welcome to episode 34 of the Behind the Curtain Ministry Podcast. I am Noah Filipiak, your host, and today's guest is David Stahl. David is the president and CEO of Kids Hope USA. Kids Hope is a national nonprofit. It partners with local churches, and it partners churches up with local elementary schools. It'll train your church and provide mentors to at-risk students. That's something very close to my heart. Being in inner city Lansing, Michigan, where that is certainly a need. Kids Hope USA is America's largest faith-based mentoring program. It serves 20,000 kids through a network of 40,000 volunteers across 34 states. You can find more at kidshopeusa.com. David, formerly, before taking this position, was a communications director and also children's ministry director at Willow Creek Community Church. He is the author of 6 books, most recently the book Show Up, which we'll talk about a bit today. You can find more about David at davidstahl.net, and on social media at david_stahl. David, thanks for joining us today on the Behind the Curtain podcast.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you today, Noah.
David and I met in a transforming community. For those that have been following the podcast for a while, I interviewed Ruth Haley Barton back on episode 12. I would encourage you to go back and re-listen to that if you're just checking out the podcast now. But David and I met through this transforming community. We have a covenant in our transforming community. We're not allowed to share things that, you know, what happens at the TC stays at the TC. You know, that's the motto. But, David, I am hoping we can talk a little bit about our experience together. I know we're not totally done yet. We'll be done this July, and this is your second time through the TC. But for me, it's been a life-changing experience. So for those that don't know, it's about 70 ministry leaders. There's 9 retreats over a 2-year period of time. And for me, it's hard to put into words what the transforming community has done for me as a leader and even as a Christian. And I'm wondering, to start out, if you can kind of share your experience on what the transforming community has done for you both times that you've been through it.
Yeah, no, I mean, let's face it, the fact that it leaves you without words is somewhat shocking. You know?
Correct.
But other than that, you know, it's been an amazing experience for me. And I don't say that word real flippantly as far as amazing, because as a leader, I faced a point in my sort of self-awareness as a leader that I knew that in the role that I had, that I would eventually burn out, which most leaders need to pay attention to, as far as it's most of the time, it's not if, it's when. And how long is that going to take? And what can you do now to prevent that? And so it was a few years ago. I had known Ruth Haley Barton for a number of years. We had worked on a church staff together. And I started going there primarily for the silence and solitude portion of those retreats, because I don't know about you, but boy, I need a break every now and then just from hearing my own voice, if nothing else.
Right.
You know, because I spew out a lot of words every day, and after a while I get really tired of hearing, you know, that same little voice, which is mine. And so to have a rhythm of life where every quarter I go away for a couple days, and it's not about me, and it's not about any idea, and it's not to go brainstorm. It's really to let my brain just sort of rest and to let my heart slow down so that my soul can really revive itself. That's been a treasured portion of my life for, you know, the last three, almost 4 years now. And yes, I went through a community, which is 9 retreats. They're all quarterly. I went through one community and then signed up right again for another one because at first I thought it was because, you know, I'm just slow and I just need to repeat. But more than that, it's a matter of my deep commitment to a rhythm of life that allows my soul to be replenished and allows me to thrive in life more than just, you know, trying to run faster than the burnout that's trying to catch up with me. Mm-hmm. So that's my perspective on it. And honestly, Noah, the quarterly retreat has been life-changing for me. But what it's spun off is then each month I take a day, and by day I mean 6 or 8 hours, where I go off. It's in between retreats, so the 2 months in between the quarters, where I go by myself and I go someplace so that there's 6 to 8 hours of me not spewing out any words at all. And so I'm quiet, I'm alone, and all that. And again, I don't put the pressure on myself to, you know, hear some great new idea, to hear some new calling, some new book idea, some new message idea, or article idea, or anything. I'm not there to brainstorm. You know, I'm there to just, you know, be still and know that God is God and I am not. And, you know, we just sit there together in complete silence. And, you know, I don't know about you, but the first time that I started doing this, it was freaky.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. It was freaky. That inner voice inside of me did not want quiet. And so all of a sudden, you know, I'm on my first quarterly retreat, I remember, you know, I've got an extended period of solitude for like 8 or 9 hours during that retreat to start. And, you know, I'm about like 18 minutes into it. I'm like, I don't know if I can last. So I had to grind through that the first couple times, really. And that was really my entire body giving myself permission to be quiet and to be good in the quiet. Now I find myself longing for the quiet a lot of days. And, and I've even gone as far as when I drive to work, I have about a 25-minute drive. I don't get on my phone. I don't turn on, you know, Pandora. I don't do anything. And I'm good with the quiet. And, you know, although my van has a couple of, you know, rattles and squeaks and all that, that probably need some attention, but I'm good with the quiet. And I don't know who said it, but somebody really wise said it one time that, you know, if you're not good with the quiet, you're not going to be good in the noise.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that van and mentioning your van noise is actually a pretty good analogy, because we have those same noises in our life, little things that are off that need some attention, but instead of giving them attention, we just turn up the volume of the radio a little bit louder, and it's a quick fix. I'll use that to transition into. So first of all, I'll say this before I transition into the show up book. For me, my first retreat, it was like detox from the noise. I told Ruth that it was like a drug detox, where that first night I couldn't sleep. At the retreats, they make us turn our phones off and turn off all technology, and everything in me wanted to check my email, and it just felt like my world was falling apart. There's something very wrong with that, and now I'm so glad a year and a half in, the thing I most look forward to is getting to turn off my phone and to be away from technology. And you mentioned this is at the beginning of your book, and show up, you're defining what's showing up means. And you talk about how your daughter crawls into bed with you, and when you were going through your cancer, and your daughter was very young, and she hugged you, and you had a phrase that stood out to me. You said, "Nothing can replace personal presence." And I underlined that, and it reminded me of this topic of technology. It reminded me of how busy we are and the noise that we have. I mean, as you reflect on our culture, what is it about technology that keeps us from showing up with personal presence in people's lives?
Well, that's a great question, because as study after study has shown, we were created hardwired to connect mm-hmm. with one another. We are relational beings, okay? But what happens is that we've gone wireless. And so all of a sudden, the connection that everybody's heart really longs for is person to person. I mean, that is placed in everybody's heart, when they're born and all that. But what happens is that technology all of a sudden chews up time and chews up space and chews up attention. And the result of that is that people feel like they don't have enough time. Mm-hmm. And and that has been true, Noah, for centuries, where people don't feel like they have enough time to do everything that they want. And what happens is that, so that's nothing new. But what's happened is what gets prioritized now. And so, I've got a Twitter account, I've got an Instagram account, Facebook, all that kind of stuff. So it's not like I'm anti-social media or anything like that. But what happens is that all of a sudden, with a growing number of folks, the social media interaction is prioritized higher than personal interaction. Mm-hmm. And that's the big change. Before, people didn't have enough time because they needed to travel, to meet one another. They traveled with one another. They did, there was all this one another time, and it squeezed out other things in life. And so, prioritization and the need to prioritize is nothing new. It's age old. However, what's happened is that there's been higher priority given to what's going on with the phone in my hand or my iPad or whatever than there is as far as looking at somebody eye to eye and spending time with them. And, it comes down to this. What is most important to you? Because everybody is given the same amount of time. And that sounds so cliche. It really does. But yet, I still look at it and say, and the choice is yours. You're choosing to spend your time one way or versus spending time with somebody. And at the end of the day, when you're really down and you really need somebody, you really struggled in life, and that happens a lot for me and as well as other folks, a text really doesn't do that much.
Really,
it doesn't do that much, especially when it could be an auto text or something. It just doesn't do that much. There is nothing that replaces somebody looking you in the eye, somebody nodding their head when you're talking, somebody who's just quiet with you and gives you a hug or holds your hand. Mm-hmm. There is nothing on your phone. There is no app that's going to replace that. But what's happened is that, unfortunately, too much time is spent. And so all of a sudden, there's this reliance on technology because not of what it will bring, but what am I missing?
Yeah.
And, the fact is, we've got this funny little thing as a family that we do. And my kids are grown up now, and so, I'm going back into yesteryear. But when they were both in high school, we had a very firm, rule as a family as far as there is no phone use during a family meal. Mm-hmm. And when the landline phone, which, is getting pretty rare, but right. when that would ring, I would always say the same thing, which, kind of made my kids laugh, and now they kind of roll their eyes at it. I would say, I don't care who it is, everybody who matters to me is sitting right here. Mm-hmm. So I don't, I'm not talking to anybody.
Yeah.
And that's a choice. And, you know, I'm guilty of everybody as far as, you know, am I making the right choices with my time? But
yeah,
I think that's what's really going on in the book, Noah, is not an anti-technology book. It really isn't. I really don't even bring up cell phones or anything like that, because that's sort of a, okay, that's today. What's tomorrow going to bring as far as prioritizations and all that? But the Show Up book really is just a very common sense recipe to change the world. If you'll go ahead and define the world as you can spend time with somebody and change their world, meaning, you know, when you show up and your personal presence will make a difference, a life-changing difference in people. And I think it's a message that people have forgotten.
Yeah, I know for me reading it, it was very reflective. And that phrase you said, I think, is very helpful, that we've all been given the same amount of time. So what's going to be most important to you? Something for me, you know, I'm 34. I have kids now that are 5 and 3, and my wife is pregnant. So we're going to have 3 girls in the house pretty soon. I'll have 4, including my wife. So I'm very outnumbered. But, you know, things –
So we pause the podcast for a brief prayer for Noah.
That's right. Pray for me and don't stop. Pray for me and don't ever stop. my 5-year-old's hitting her teenage years early, I think, already. So it's been an adventure here at the Filipiak household. But you know, I love being a dad, and it's awesome. And, you have kids, and it's a whole new world. I mean, it changes your perspective, and that's part of life. You get older. I remember when I was a kid and when I was in high school, it sort of just feels like you're going to be in school forever. Like, this will never end. And you have a very limited perspective on time. I'm in my mid-30s now, and I have some kids of my own. And as soon as that happens, you're – perspective changes. You start thinking, and now, you know, all my grandparents have passed away, and my parents are in good health, and my wife's parents are in good health, though my mother-in-law went through a very scary time with breast cancer. Most people that have the cancer she had die from it, and she's gone through that and is okay now, but My parents and Jen's parents are in their 60s, you know, mid-60s. And your book, you talked a lot, and I don't think you did this intentionally, but it just shows a depth and a maturity where you talked a lot about experiences with death, your own near-death experience with cancer, and then several loved ones of yours that died. And I bring it up because part of the transforming community experience for me has shown me, and there's a lot of deep things I won't get into here, but there's a part of death I don't have a framework for yet. That glass has not yet been broken in my life where a really close loved one has died. One of my parents, you know, God forbid, one of my children. But these are traumatic things that people go through. I think I still carry a feeling of invincibility about myself as a former athlete, a wannabe still athlete. You know, I feel like I'm still in control, I'm still healthy, you know, these sorts of things. So my question for you, David, is you're very vulnerable about death throughout your book. One story that came to mind I want to ask you about, and it really made me reflective. You are sitting on the pier at Lake Michigan, and you describe a group of adult children who are throwing the ashes of their parents into Lake Michigan. And I could just relate because I'm that adult child right now. And what got to me, and I live in Michigan, you know, I live about an hour and a half from Lake Michigan where you live. And what got to me was they said, this is the very spot, this very pier is where my dad proposed to my mom. That that was a tearjerker for me. Because that spot is still there. You sit there and reflect on a regular basis. I can go visit there. That dad looked into his girlfriend's eyes and said, will you marry me? They had a family. Now they've passed, and hopefully they're with the Lord now. But it hits me. There's all these Bible verses that talk about your life is but a mist. It's here one day. It's gone tomorrow. It's like a wildflower in the field. Yet in our culture, we seem to act like we live forever, and I think you have such a perspective on this with the your battle with cancer that you talk about a lot and show up. So can you talk about how showing up has a lot to do with that type of personal presence that has an understanding that we're not here forever? Because I think that's a big lie that our culture buys into, is you're going to live forever here on this earth, live for the moment, live for now, live for yourself. And there's something that we're really, really missing that I'm just, as a 34-year-old, I'm just starting to get my head wrapped around what is actually important to me.
Yeah. I mean, that's those are some heavy thoughts, but they're ones that, hey, you know what? Death is something that you just can't ignore.
Yeah.
You know, it's very real. And, I've sat with an oncologist who gave me, 50% chance of living 5 years. Mm-hmm. And, I looked at that as far as, wow, that's a wake up call. And, I developed a philosophy of life. And again, that sounds so heroic. Like, I sat down and developed a philosophy of life. No, actually, a philosophy of life was thrust upon me. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I wear it like a tattoo. And it's this, that when you believe that your days are numbered, you commit to make them count. Mm-hmm. And, the at the end of the day, when the concepts in the show up book come out, hopefully, and point towards this direction, is that, why not give your personal presence to people? A lot of times people hesitate to do that because they believe that tomorrow will come and that they'll have other opportunities, or that, next week or whatever. And they push things off. And I am very guilty of that too. Or I believe somebody else will take care of it. But in terms of with show up, and the folks that I interact with in the book and all that, they taught me that, to truly live is to interact with people and as the subtitle of the book says, step out of your own story for a moment and into someone else's. And it's a fascinating life. Again, it's staying true to who we've been created to be as relational beings, where if I can muster the energy, as I say in the book, a calorie of forward motion, if I can do that and step out of my busyness, in other words, stop worrying about myself here, mm-hmm. and prioritizing myself, and step into somebody else's story, then I get to live a part of their life with them. And there is something extremely sacred about that. Yeah. And there's something eternal about that too. That I'm really caught up with. I remember that day on the pier in Grand Haven like it was yesterday, because literally I'm sitting there listening to worship music on my iPhone, in my earbuds, and the waves are rolling, and it's a big wave day out there, which is a lot of fun, and the sun was out and all that. It was just great day to be out there, and literally the first one of their group went to throw either mom's or dad's ashes over off the pier. I really thought they were getting too close to the pier. I didn't know what they were doing. I thought they were getting too close to the pier. I took my wallet out of my pants pocket. I took my iPhone and set it aside. I really thought, no, I was going to have to jump into the water. I really, because I'm like, they don't know, but you cannot stand that close to the end of the pier. You're going to get swept away. And so, the first indication of, hey, death is a theme here was, I might need to save your life right now. But then when I saw that they really weren't in danger anymore, that's when I just asked them. And again, it would have been so like me usually to just put the earbuds back in and go back to my own thoughts.
Yeah.
And, kind of getting back to that whole transforming center as far as being okay with the quiet, which to me, quiet is not having to listen to myself all day long. That's a close neighbor to, okay, if I don't have to listen to myself all day long, and it's good to not do that,
that means I can interact with other people. Mm-hmm. And it is not heroic to ask somebody what they're doing when they're throwing stuff in the water on a pier in Lake Michigan, but it was a special moment for that family, that just because I was interested, I was able to step into their family for just a moment and experience something tremendous, because you know, they throw the ashes in and they go one by one and they do it, and you know, they're choking back tears and they're remembering this stuff, and I am too, and it's this magical moment, we thought, and then all of a sudden, you know, a big wave crashes after they've thrown the ashes in there, and a rainbow appears, and then another wave comes right after that, and another rainbow appears. There's two rainbows, and you know, one of the adult children that were throwing the ashes in said, "Oh, you know, that's mom and dad," and you know, it was so like them because they so loved one another. Mm. And you know, at that point in time, I was like, "Wow, you know, I should be taking off my shoes because I am standing on holy ground right now." And you know, it was at that point in time, and I wasn't really thinking about the death aspect of it. No, what I was thinking about was more of, do I so love my wife?
Wow. Yeah.
You know, in a way that shows to others, so that you know, one day when I'm gone, you know, what's going to be said about me? Not that I'm worried about building this great reputation, but I looked at it as far as that man's love for his wife and his wife's love for him, and all that made a forever impression on their children, and it made an impression on me, and it'll make an impression on anybody who reads a book. And all of a sudden I thought, yeah, wow, they have just put an eternal stamp on their love, because it's going to impact people. And you know, honestly, as I left, you know, the pier that day, just thinking about the whole love comment and all that, you know, the 1 Corinthians 13 became very real to me, you know, and these three remain, faith, hope, and love, and the greatest is love. I was like, yeah, love does remain.
Wow.
And their love lives on, and it still has an impact, and it's, you know, exactly the way it should be. So, yeah, it was quite a moment, and I just encourage everybody, that's why I wrote the book, I encourage everybody to be willing to step out of their story and into someone else's for just a moment. And see what happens. And a lot of times nothing will happen, Noah. And it's not the point that you do that and every time there's going to be magic and rainbows and love and all that kind of stuff. A lot of times nothing will happen. But occasionally something will happen.
Yeah.
And if you're just willing to, you know, set aside that busyness and that, you know, sort of that safe zone, that a bubble that many of us walk around in, and venture out of that and into somebody else's life for just a moment, you never know what will happen.
Well, often you're not going to see, you won't always see what will happen either. You know, I think about that couple who had passed away, the married couple that showed all that love. I mean, and what hits me about that story is how many relationships end in divorce nowadays? How many relationships don't even go to marriage anymore? I mean, that in my generation and the one younger than me, marriage is becoming more and more of a foreign concept, as love is becoming more and more of a foreign concept. There's so much about the self and this idea of sacrificial love that's not self-seeking is becoming more and more foreign. And you get divorced, and I'm sorry, you get married, and then you think about all the temptation for divorce along the way, potentially that couple had, but they stuck with it. They loved each other, and that the story wouldn't have been anything had the marriage not lasted. They proposed on that pier, and their ashes were thrown in together on that pier. It's this continuity of their love for each other showing up, like you said, showing up for your wife. And I think that's what's so helpful about your book, is it's not saying that we have to be heroes. We don't have to do these heroic things, these huge things, because it can often feel that way as Christians, that I have to do something amazing and world-changing. But these small things, whether we see it or not, sometimes we do get to see it, and that's pretty awesome. Then other times, we're just planting seeds, and God brings fruit later, and God gets the glory for it, and we never even know that it happens. And I see that in that story. And to me, that's what's so powerful. It had me reflecting so much. One story you told was about a girl from your elementary school. You know, we're talking way back, and a girl named Lori that you describe. And you know, we don't have to get into the whole story, but it got me reflecting. Basically, she was a. I'll let readers read it, because that was a part of the story where I wept. I mean, I had tears coming down my face, and I am literally, because it was a girl that got made fun of in your school, basically, and it made me think about, as a kid, I was a Christian kid, sounded like you were as well, and how many kids that I made fun of or that I went along with when others were making fun of, and a lot of times it was girls, and that was the joke, was, oh, you're with that girl. Like, that was the joke, was you were with this and fill in the blank type of girl. And I think about how it could have been different for me had I instead shown up in that kid's life that was getting bullied and picked on because they were poor or because they had a disability or whatever it might be. And what it did for me, honestly, is I'm going to go and open my yearbook. This is you can hold me accountable to this. I just finished the book last week. I'm like, this one specific girl, and I don't know her last name, so I can't find her on Facebook. I'm gonna open my yearbook, find her last name. I hope I can find her and write her a letter about my faith in Christ and how I screwed up when I was in elementary school. And she got picked on so much, and she is who I was thinking of in that story. And it made me think, as kids, I think we can reflect on that a lot. We can think of the kid who got picked on that we didn't stand up for because we were busy trying to be cool or popular. But that translates into adult life as well. I mean, there's so many adults who are getting picked on by society that we can show up for. That translates into adult life because there's still those kids in school that are getting picked on that nobody loves, that are lonely, and that's where some of your kids' hope stories brought me so much hope, because I thought, you know, who knows? Well, yeah, I was the fifth grade punk kid who was too worried about myself, but hopefully there was an adult mentor, someone like that in their life who was showing up for them. I guess I'll just say this, and I'll phrase this into a question, is for me, there was a lot of conviction about, when I was a kid especially, times I didn't show up in other kids' lives. And things that I want to do, like track down, hopefully, there's two specific girls, that, and one of them I know I can write to because she was in my youth group and I still have her, I have her on Facebook. But there's people that I want to repent to and say, Jesus loves you and I love you and the church loves you. What are some ways that, you know, Kids Hope provides these things, or ways that you can just give adults listening to this that can relate to some of these stories of regret, some ways that adults can show up in people's lives? How do I identify people who might need this? Identify kids or other adults who might be lonely, who might be getting beat up on, picked on, and just not heroic ways, but practical and real ways that we can start doing this sort of showing up.
Yeah, I mean, what a great question, and what an immense need in our world today. The one of the big points of the whole Lori story was that there I was in fifth grade, and something that happened in fifth grade. And again, I don't want to blow the story because it's near the end of the book and all that. But something that happened to me in fifth grade shaped who I became as an adult, and how I've, you know, decided to invest my life. And it wasn't that Lori, you know, led me to a saving relationship with Jesus or anything like that. It was really, really very simple and extremely profound. And so given that context and that story, then, you know, we look and we say, all right, and again, I'll put on my Kids Hope hat here for a while. You know, that means that as an adult, you have an opportunity through Kids Hope or whatever program it is to go invest in the life of a young person right now and have a similar influence on them as far as simple things you do with them, for them, whatever, can make a profound difference in who they become. And you know, there's so many kids in our schools today, in Lansing, in whatever city you want to name, there are so many kids who have nobody influencing them in a positive way. And so then we act surprised when all of a sudden, you know, kids grow up, they become youth that seem to be lost, and they do all sorts of, you know, whatever things and all that. And we're surprised. And I look at that and say, this is not hard. You know, at Kids Hope, we equip churches to train mentors to go in and spend an hour with an at-risk student. And it's not to do anything complicated. It's not to tutor. It's not to do anything like that. It's to build a life-giving relationship that will be life-changing for that student. And guess what? Every student needs that. Yeah. Every student's, you know, worldview, if you will, is being shaped. And I'm not talking about going in and evangelizing kids. That, you know, we have clear separation of church-state boundaries that we insist on everybody adhering to. But as I look back at the story of the impact Lori had on my life, it was a God thing going on right then. You know, God was shaping the young man who I would become.
Yeah.
And it did not require evangelism as we have been sort of programmed to believe evangelism is these days, where it's a catchy illustration, it's catchy words and all that. Those have their place. And I wrote a book called Leading Kids to Jesus, which tells you all about how to do that stuff. Mm. But I'm looking at more of who is bringing God's love into who's bringing love into the school, and just for love's sake. And, you know, too many kids are walking around and they don't have a caring adult relationship in their life, and they are on a love deficit life journey right now. And the greatest resource that today's church has is the capacity of its members to go and love other people. That is the greatest resource that every church has. And, you know, my book, my organization, everything encourages that greatest resource to be unleashed and deployed in the world. It doesn't cost anything, doesn't require training, doesn't take a lot of complexity. But what it does is it takes a realization that, you know, that kids need somebody who's loving them, who will be there for them, who will show up in their life on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And once that happens, extraordinary change can happen. And it might not be this week or next week. It might be years down the road or whatever. But at the end of the day, you know that you made a difference in somebody's life. Yeah, I have the privilege of traveling all over the country, talking with our programs and prospective programs and all that. When I'm standing in front of a room full of mentors and I ask them about that moment when they arrive at school and their little guy or little girl who they're going to meet with sees them at the door and you make eye contact, I said, is there any greater moment of your life that you will live that week than that moment right there? And everybody agrees. Because there's just something amazing about it when you show up for somebody out of the goodness of your heart, motivated by love, that there is something amazing that takes place that I just long for other people to experience. I'm a mentor also. I mentor a little guy every Monday at 11:40 a.m. And you know what? That's the highlight of my week because I step out of my busyness, I step out of my story, step into, you know, the one that he and I have. But, you know, there's amazing opportunities to relate to people and to have the ministry of your presence felt by other people. And it does not require you to be a theologian, to be a witty evangelist or anything like that. If you just have the ability to look somebody in the eye, to smile, to laugh, to cry, to nod,
you know, that's all it takes.
What you were mentioning with the church, I see so often because, the church is the resource. I mean, biblically, the church is the resource. The church is the hands and feet of Jesus. And I'm in a unique spot where I grew up in, categories have their limits, but I'll just use some categories here. I grew up in a suburban church in a suburban town. I currently am a pastor of an urban church in a low-income urban section of an urban city of Lansing. And so what I have a lot, and this is a pretty cool thing, I have a lot of networks that are in the suburban areas and a lot of friends, a lot of pastor friends, and they're continually asking me, hey, we have these people in our church, and they love Jesus. They love the scriptures, and God is working in us that we want to get involved. You know, we know this resource is here, and it's untapped, right? And then you look into any school. It can be, my wife works out in a small rural community called Weberville near Lansing. It's the furthest thing from inner city that there is. It's a small farming community, very homogenous, very rural. And there's tons of poverty there as well. There's tons of lonely kids there as well. And so I don't care if it's urban, suburban, or rural. When you're talking about schools, there are kids there who they are lonely and they are looking for love. And there's a huge need. So you have this huge need in schools, and I will say, you know, in the inner city, that's just what I see every day. So that's kind of my story. But there's a huge need there, and then you have a huge resource in the church. And what I love, and I mean love to see, is organizations like Kids Hope, who are the bridge between the two, because often all that's needed is a logistical bridge that can bridge the church and all of the resources there. I'm talking about people that are full of love. They're full of the love of Christ. They're overflowing with love, and they're saying, what do I do with this love? And frankly, a lot of them are bored. They're saying, is this all there is? And often the church, we've gotten into this rut, I think, of just teaching people to behave. Okay, go to church, behave, be a good person. There has to be an overflow, though, to that life of love. And in the overflow, one of those ways, I'm asking listeners to consider, because, we're busy. We are. And you're never going to not be busy completely. We can curb some things back. But spending an hour a week with a kid, you can do that. We're not asking you to be a hero, right? This is what I love about this, is that it's you're going to be a hero to that kid for sure, but we're not saying you need to go start your own nonprofit. You don't need to reinvent.
Right.
You don't need to reinvent the wheel. I meet so many Christians that are looking, that want to reinvent the wheel because they get passionate about this type of ministry. And so with that, why don't we conclude with this, David? I'm curious, because Kids Hope is a little new to me, but what regions are you in? You don't have to list all of them, I guess, but how does somebody find out if where they live, if there's already a Kids Hope presence there? And if somebody wanted to start a new Kids Hope presence, is that something they can do if there's not one already in their region or their school district?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, we Kids Hope is structured where we help a church partner with a public school. Now, here's the best part, is that we have a little over 1,200 of these church school programs, and we're in 34 different states. So I'm going to guess that everybody listening right now probably has a program in your state. You can go to our website and see exactly where all the programs are. And it's all a church and a school partnering at the start, and then the church sends mentors. But so I mentioned that we have about 1,200 or so, a little over that, church school programs. Noah, we have 2,500 public schools waiting for a church partner.
Wow.
So if there is a Kids Hope program near you, I guarantee there are schools near you who would love to have a church run this program. And why is that? It's very simple, because educators spend all day, all week long with the kids who are, you know, with kids in their classes and all that. They see the difference that love makes in these kids' lives. And what they do is they start telling their colleagues about it. and principals get together, you know, at least once a month, if not twice a month, and they start talking about this program that we had. And so all of a sudden, then more principals want the program. We did a survey a couple of years back as far as with principals who have a Kids Hope program, and 100% of them said they recommend it to their peers. Wow. And would insist on it if they ever change schools. So go to kidshopeusa.org, and there's an inquiry form you can fill out, and we have a team of people waiting that have started programs all over the country, and so we work with everybody. But there's this one picture that, and I'll leave it right here with this picture. There was a principal who wanted a program in his school and talked with a pastor. And the pastor said, okay, well, we're going to put this to a congregational vote. Would you like to come this Sunday and share a couple words? The principal said, yes, I would. And so the principal shows up, and he stands up during announcement time, and he's addressing the congregation, and he can sense that there's some low energy in this. He's inviting them to come into his school. He can sense that there's low energy, and he says, well, I know you're going to vote on this. And he said, if for some reason you vote no, then I'm going to ask you if you would please just send a couple people to the school one day a week to stand by the fence around our playground and wave to a few of the loneliest kids, because that will make a difference. If you can't say yes to the program, can you at least come and wave at the kids? Now you think about that as far as that's what educators are facing. Wow. In our world today, yeah. In our country today, yeah. Is kids with such a deficit, they would respond to a wave. I'm saying, no, let's have a wave of people into the schools and just love the kids.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Wow. You know, and I'll say this to conclude. You hear people all the time, and I've been guilty of it too, we complain about the schools. And often it's, I'm in an inner city school district, and those inner city schools, and it's sometimes you'll hear it's the teachers, it's the administration, and you know, my wife's a teacher. She's out in a rural district, but she's been a teacher for 12 years now, and her mom was a teacher in an elementary school before her. And so the thing is a teacher and an administrator can only do so much. When you have a huge breakdown of the family in our culture, you have lots of best case scenario sometimes is a single parent who's really loves their kids, but they have to work two or three jobs to make ends meet, and so the kids neglect it that way. But often, man, you'll have these kids, some of these kids in a inner city or suburban or rural, I mean, so you talk about child abuse, you talk about drug addicted parents, and then you wonder, you see there's a neglect of love there that changes culture, it changes society. And wow, what an opportunity for Christians. I mean, what an opportunity for the church to step in. And the other complaint we hear a lot, rightfully so, is, you know, they've taken prayers out of schools and all this kind of stuff. And, well, we're being invited now into the schools because schools are desperate for love. They're desperate because they see the plight of these kids. And so, listeners, pastors especially, pastors listening, churches, encourage your pastor to check out kidshopeusa.org. There is all kinds of great resources and helps there on how to get connected. I will be posting this podcast as usual at my blog, which is at acrossroads.net. I'll have all the links there, so you can go there and find the interview with David, and we'll have a link to his newest book, Show Up, as well as his other books he's written, which are about church kids ministry, kind of generally speaking through Zondervan, some really, really helpful books there that I'll be referring our kids ministry director to. But really encourage you to get the newest book, Show Up, and we'll have a link. We'll have all of David's social media stuff as well that you can connect with him and with Kids Hope USA. And most importantly, just be in prayer. I mean, prayer for Kids Hope USA, prayer for your local schools, prayer for your church. One of the reasons I do this podcast is because I want to see, not just this podcast, but my ministry in life as a pastor, is I want to see the church unleashed. And when I see opportunities and very practical ways for the church to get unleashed, gets me very excited. So, David, thank you for helping me get excited about this, because I think there's a lot of fruit. Thank you for serving faithfully, and thanks for coming on the podcast today.
Well, thank you for having me, Noah, and thanks for leading the way through this. So I appreciate you, appreciate your ministry.
All right, well, we'll see you next month at our next retreat. And listeners, we will see you, not really seeing, but that's corny radio talk for we will talk next time on the next episode of the Behind the Curtain Ministry podcast. This concludes episode 34. Encourage you to check out the rest of the episodes on Podbean as well as on iTunes. And again, especially refer you to episode 12, which is with Ruth Haley Barton. If you want to check out more about transforming communities and you are a ministry leader, I highly recommend it. I will link to those as well, which is the transformingcenter.org. Until next time, I will see you at a crossroads and behind the curtain. Thank you.